Well, we'll go ahead and get started, and it's just going to be real casual. So, I'm Bob Whidden. I'm the executive director at Hope Harbor.
Good job.
Hope Harbor in Claremore, near Tulsa, and in 3 years, our convention or conference will be in Claremore. So, you'll be able to see where Will Rogers grew up. Never met a man he didn't like.
Where Will Rogers claimed to grow up. He did not, in fact, grow up in Claremore. He was from Ooliga, and he could not stand the way that non-Oklahoma people pronounced Ooliga, so he just said Claremore because people could pronounce it. So we've taken that and run with it.
And Claremore was a spelling mistake.
Yeah, the way that Claremore got its name was that a recorder at the county or something, when it was proposed that this city was to be called Claremont, and she wrote it down Claremore, and from then on it was always Claremore. So not really sure what Claremore means, but not even sure what Claremont means.
Claremont was a person. Claremore means city of people who cannot spell.
City of people who cannot spell. All right. And let's see. So anyway, Claremore, it's near Tulsa, it's on Route 66, and we'll just have a lot of fun doing that in about 3 years. So we're going to talk to you about a model that we have instituted that we call Intentional Hope. But my co-presenter this morning is, introduce yourself.
I'm Jennifer Bristow. I'm the clinical director at Hope Harbor. And so what we want to talk to you about today is just kind of our history, where we've come from, and where we're going, and our journey towards what has become exclusively family reconciliation. Is that enough?
And when we started this process to get this presentation going, we actually found out a lot about ourselves, that our family reconciliation model has pretty much been with us in one form or another since the very beginning. Hope Harbor started out as Church of Christ Children's Home in 1947, and it was placed in the Turley area of Tulsa. Now, back then, I guess that was just
the middle of nowhere
back then, north of Tulsa. And after about a year, they changed the name to Turley Children's Home. And so a lot of older folks remember Turley Children's Home. And it was there from 1947 till about 1996. And so, but from the very beginning, there has been the efforts and the ideas to reconcile families. Of course, our children's home was created or started as a result of a need, like most children's homes about that time, to take care of displaced children because of World War II. And so, but even then, there weren't necessarily true orphans. They still maybe they lost a dad or a grandfather in the war, but they still had some kind of parent or grandparent to go back to. And so a lot of the kids that came to Turley Children's Home at that time were actually groups of children from the same family groups, that we would take care of for a while, maybe while the mother would go off and try to find something to do to make a living to get her children back. And that's what we were focusing on back then, is to reunite the families at that point as well.
And for those of you who are house parents, the cottages averaged 25 kids at that point.
So just basically cramming in as many children as we can. And
that was little kids. The older ones had an army barracks that they slept in. They disassembled an army barracks and reassembled it on our campus. Oh, am I in the thing?
So this is actually a cottage that was on the original Turley campus. And by the way, I'll just kind of jump forward a little bit. By the early 90s, that part of Tulsa had grown, has deteriorated so much that it wasn't safe for our children or staff members to be in that part of Tulsa. And so it was by God's decree, evidently, or God's design, that a guy named Robert Tucker, who lived outside of Claremore, who wasn't even Christian as far as I remember, as I've read about him, wanted to help children and offered to let Turley come out and build a campus out there as long as he was allowed to stay in this house. He had one house on this huge acreage out there. And he says, as long as I'm allowed to live there until I die, and you guys need to kind of take care of me. And they said, sure.
And that would be your whole base of operations.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in 1996, they moved out there. There was an older cottage of ours built, and it was built onto several times. And so if you go into our oldest cottage there, you can tell it's an add-on, because you'll go in and you can see it in the ceiling, and you see hallways going there and there, and it's just kind of weird. But actually, Randy Scow, from Mountain States Children's Home, he was actually the assistant director at that time, and he was also a carpenter, and he helped build that first cottage out on our campus. The campus at Turley was sold to the state of Oklahoma, and it is now a prison, a women's prison. And I was
pre-release facility,
not a maximum security prison, but. And I was saying that one time at some presentation, and the lady says, "You mean that's where I was at?" And it's up in Turley, right? And she named the name of the facility or whatever. I said, "That's probably it." So anyway, it's a prison facility up there in the Turley area. So, but since then, of course, we grew to. This is one of our newer cottages on the campus at Hope Harbor. This is probably Maybe Cottage. I don't know. We have a Tucker Cottage, Maybe Cottage, and a Chapman Cottage. And each of these cottages have four bedrooms. And it was designed to maybe house two kids per each bedroom. And so we had eight at one time. But over the years, we decided to drop it down to six, more manageable. And so that's where it came from. The other thing about kids in doubling up rooms at children's homes, we're having trouble, and I'm sure you guys are too, with same-sex people in the same bedroom. And so we're building a new cottage right now, and it'll have six bedrooms, and we will only have one child in each bedroom. And so that's by design. And then eventually those older cottages, we have three that have four bedrooms each for the children. Those will turn into what we call lighthouse cottages. That'll take care of some of the more high needs or high risk children. And we're going to hire, we call them residential life specialists, not house parents, but because they also provide a little bit of therapy in what that they do. We're going to find residential life specialists that don't have little children. Because sometimes we have a kid that comes to us, and one of the problems is that they didn't get along, or they were kind of violent to younger children. And of course, we can't take them because most of our house parents have little children of their own. And so eventually those cottages will be for those higher risk or higher needs kids here. So anyway, that's where we came from. I know that I've only been at Hope Harbor for about 3 years. It'll be 3 years in June. And I was impressed when I got there at Hope Harbor because they had a fantastic program, for the children. And it is a 9-step model of, what do we call that? Growing in character. Growing in character model. And it's just very good. It helps the children mature, get ready to go home. And at the same time, I noticed that we had workshops and we tried to get the parents to campus, but it was a struggle. I said, well, why can't we have a 9-step program for the adults as well? And so, we talked about it. I remember being in her office and maybe there was someone else there, and we started throwing out some ideas, and I'm a marriage counselor by trade, and so we threw out some stuff, and all of a sudden she says, wow, and she started typing. And within an hour, we actually had a document, a very rough draft of a document and nine steps that the parents could go through. And then we polished it and we launched it, and we now require the parents to go through their own model, growing in care, intentional hope is what we call it. Intentional hope. And so I actually have a document that I want to give to you, but I didn't want to bring copies. I didn't know how many people would be here. So if you'll leave me your email, I will send this to you. And it'll basically explain the 9 steps. But they're also general enough to where you're supposed to make them personal for each family. And so we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. So that's basically the quick history of Hope Harbor.
Okay. So just to run through kind of how briefly, very briefly, family reconciliation has looked over the years. Our goal was always to get kids back to their families. In 1947, the goal was to get kids back to their families. But it didn't always work, right? Some kids could not go home, should not go home, or were really doing great with us and just did not go home. So we had lots of kids in the 40s and 50s and 60s who stayed through high school graduation. We actually, in the 50s, started doing individual therapy, and dates get real murky, as they do as years pass. But sometime in the late 70s or early 80s, definitely by 1985, we were doing also family therapy and group therapy for every child that had a family. So that was exciting. But we still had families who didn't have families and things like that to work with. So we had lots of kids who would come with us and live with us and stay with us forever and then graduate high school, and we would kind of become their de facto family, which is, you know, we're wonderful and great and all that, but really not the ideal situation for any child to grow up outside of their own home. So we begin to work more on involving families. And so about 2002, we got an executive director who was a clinical psychologist, specialized in trauma, and began to really push us to work specifically with children who had experienced a large number of adverse childhood experiences. And when I came on board, that's why they liked me, is I'm a trauma nerd too. So you guys want to talk trauma? I'm your girl. It's fun. I love it. So what happened over the years is we began to institute more things to try to encourage families to come. We made pastime part of the program. Before 1997, pastime was optional if the therapist thought that you should have it, which as a therapist, I find a little yucky. After that, we started saying everyone should do pastime unless you show up and appear to be intoxicated or something. And then we didn't do that. So we started seeing very naturally more and more children with trauma histories, more complex trauma histories. So what happened over the years is that between when we started gathering ACEs data, do you guys know about ACEs? Raise your hand if you know about ACEs. Okay, I don't want to bore you guys to death, but I want to tell the other guys. So ACEs are adverse childhood experiences. And the research on ACEs is very, very cool because it's a very unusual study. It was done on middle-class white people, thousands and thousands of middle-class white people who are not normally who you get for research. And like all great psychological research, it was not, in fact, done by a psychologist. It was done by an obesity doctor who was designing a study on obesity and trying to help people lose weight, and he was very effective, and people were losing weight and feeling great about life and dropping out of his study, which was very distressing to him. So he started interviewing people. What's going on? What is happening with these people who are being successful, losing weight, and dropping out of my beautiful weight loss intervention? So he starts asking questions, and then one day he flubbed. He messed his question up, and I love that because I mess my words up all the time, and unintentionally asked the question, how much did you weigh the first time you had sex? And the woman he was interviewing said, got kind of teary and said, 40 pounds. And he thought, well, this has to be an outlier. So he starts researching, and he starts asking questions. And he ends up asking all these questions to all these people with Kaiser Permanente insurance in California, which is really high-quality, expensive insurance for people with money. Because he was like, if these things are happening, and if they're happening as much as it looks like they're happening, like, everyone would know, everyone would talk about it. And all the trauma therapists said, duh, we've been trying to tell you this. So what he ended up discovering were 10 categories of adverse childhood experiences. And if you have four or more of these adverse childhood experiences, outcomes start to look very, very bad for you. Your odds of getting an abortion if you're a young lady go up by 90%. Your risk of heart disease goes up. Your odds of having cancer go up. At six or more ACEs, your life expectancy drops by 20 years. I mean, it's huge. And so this happened in the late 90s, but it's been about 20 years, so the rest of us are finally starting to catch up. And ACEs are becoming something people are very interested in. What are these things that happen in your childhood that make you die young and have a greater likelihood of multiple sexual partners? And by the way, for the purposes of this study, the number was 48 or 50 for your multiple sexual partners. More likely to have lots of sexual partners, more likely to be divorced, more likely to report feeling dissatisfied in your relationships, so on and so forth. So in 2008, we averaged about 3.8 ACEs. In 2018, we averaged 7.2. So we're talking about very, very high trauma kids who've been through lots of rough stuff before they come to us.
And some of our kids actually had scored a 10 on the ACEs, on our ACEs evaluation, having them all.
So I would encourage you, if you're not gathering ACEs data, do it, because it's up and it's coming and people are very excited about it. And it really will change how you interact with kids. So we begin to see these kids with higher and higher trauma histories, more and more kids who were adoptions. About 87% of our kids right now are adopted. And most of them were adopted after the age of 2. So later in life adoptions, lots of adoptions. And so we begin to work with the families and have parent workshops, and we begin to kind of look at, like, some families come to our program, work really hard, do really amazing, their kids go home, they do great, yay. And sometimes kids would come and work real hard, or sometimes not work real hard, and go home and go back and actually almost seem to do worse than they did before. And so as we started looking at what is the difference, what is the difference between these two sets of kids, because they all get the same program while they're with us. And the difference is the families, right? The kids who did well, the kids who were motivated to work hard, are the kids with the involved families. The kids who went home and continued to do better were the kids with the families who stayed involved. And so we started looking at what are the things that these parents did. They came all the time. They came to have passes. They started making their phone calls on a regular basis. They showed up. They were there. They volunteered together. They got connected. They talked to each other about what their family story is. And so those things in turn became our intentional hope model. Is literally, what are people doing that's working that when you're not doing it, your family doesn't seem to do as well? So that's our model. That's what we did. And we're loving it. So the biggest thing I think for the kids is that we instituted mandatory pastime around the holidays. So also great for my house parents. They loved this rule. Everybody goes home, Thanksgiving, Christmas, July 4th, and Easter, just to have holiday space throughout the year. Because we were having kids that would be with us 2, 3, 4 Christmases and never go home and not feel connected. And that seemed to be very tied to not doing well when you left us. And so now we do. And sometimes parents are like, oh, this is wonderful. I love to spend extra time with my kid at Christmas. And some families are like, oh, my goodness, how am I going to make it through the next 24 hours? Right? Depending on where they're at and where their kids are at. But what we want to do is wrap around. And our other big benefit has been, what's the number one thing kids in residential care say about their families, especially if they're placed by their families? Yeah. You don't care about me. You sent me away. We had a problem as a family, and you sent me away as if I was the problem. How many of you have kids where the kid is the only thing that has been impacted in whatever the situation is that led up to them coming to you? Okay, nobody, right? Or else you're all asleep. Raise your hand if you're not asleep. All right, 3. Woo! Dark room. Last day of the conference, I know. So, but really, even if a family is a wonderful, high-functioning family, by the time they get to us, they are struggling. It's a big leap of faith to look at a bunch of strangers and say, hey, the most valuable thing I have in life is my child. And things are going so badly that I'm going to let my child go over here with you. And I don't really know you. But let's hope this works out. That's a lot of desperation and a lot of hurt. And even in the best circumstances, there is some hurt that has to be healed for the whole family.
Yeah, we're not naive to believe that the child is the only one that has messed up in the family. Because even as good intention as we adults are, when things start falling apart with our children, we react sometimes. We try things that maybe we have never tried before. We've heard about this. And so their own little model of discipline, their model of raising children has kind of crumbled around them, and they're frazzled as well. And so that's why we want the families, we require the families to come to campus at least once a month for family counseling, which is not this. It's not the intentional hope model. It's just family counseling. And this is what they do in their spare time. And they report to us, and we we help them out, but this is required of all the families now.
What if you have a family that just won't take the time? I have a young lady that's in our home currently. She's been with us almost 2 years. In July, it'll be 2 years. The family doesn't write. They don't send gifts. They don't come and visit. They'll make a call once a week that lasts about 15 minutes. And the week prior to coming here, no phone call. I talked to her and said, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, it's very disheartening because we've become her mom and dad.
Yeah.
Have you experienced that?
Oh, yeah.
I know our therapist, she's, you know, she'll send an email, she sends letters, trying to encourage this family who now have four children in the home, small children, to get involved with family therapy.
Well, so we took the quick and dirty route to that, which is that, well, that's what it is. So we say it costs $8,300 a month to have your child in our program. That's what we spend. We have school, we have therapists, we have 24/7 staff, we have administration, all this. Total cost, $8,300 per month. If you would like to pay that, go right ahead. No one pays that. No one has that money, right? I could triple my salary every month and still not be able to do that. And that's true for our families too. So what we say is, here's the sliding scale. We have a sliding scale. We have scholarships. We want to help you do this. We want no family to get turned away because of money. But here's the deal about our donors. Our donors are so cool and they want to help us and they want to support you. But what they want to help are families who are involved. So all of the financial aid to come here is completely dependent on you being involved in Intentional Hope. And we're going to do a quarterly audit of how you're doing. And if you don't do your Intentional Hope, you owe us back fees for the entire $8,300 per month. And so it's really shifted the conversation. Instead of saying, please come interact with your child, please come do this, what we say is, oh my goodness, I'm so worried for you. I am so worried for you. I know that you have got a lot going on, and I know that you're having these stressors, and I know you've got this stuff going on with your job. And you're about to be in a world of financial hurt, and I don't want that for you. So how can we help you get to where you need to be and meet the requirements? So things like the weekly phone call, the monthly passes, the family counseling are all part of the Intentional Hope that's required for you to get your financial aid. And that works really well because it lets us still partner with the families about how we want to help. And we're flexible. So we tell them you can miss family counseling 1 month as long as you make it up the next month, but you can't miss 2 months in a row. Because then you're not complying. And so we just work with them. And sometimes it's work. Sometimes the problem is I have a crazy work schedule and I work a low-income job and I can't take off. We've been able to work with families to help them get FMLA. This does qualify as a medical emergency for their child when their child is residing out of the home. And so far we've had 100% if the family has a job where they've been there a year and they're eligible for FMLA, that we've been able to help people get that, to be able to come do their family counseling. And we just keep pushing. So I'll do little check-ins if someone misses their phone call. So this morning was my phone call checkup morning, so I get all my logs of who's had phone calls this week, and then I shoot emails to the parents who didn't call. Hey, just wanted to check in. I noticed you missed your call this week. Is everything okay? Well, if everything's not okay, we need to know that. And if everything is okay, that's a little reminder, not being ugly, just, you all right? You missed something that's important. We still have families that are, some are more involved than others, but it pushes the group in that direction of being more connected.
And the requirements that we put on the families is really being accepted, because even families need to have hope of their own. And I went ahead and pushed up this quote here from one family that's gone through our Intentional Hope program. And basically they said, we didn't even know that we needed help, but we got it and it's fantastic. And they completed the Intentional Hope model. And they're better off because of what they've done.
And they're doing awesome. Yeah. And they are still keeping in touch with us. One of my things that surprised me when I got there is that so I've been at Hope Harbor about 4 years. We would graduate kids and we'd give them all this support and 24/7 therapists and help and on call. And then they would graduate and go home, and we would be like, God be with you. And the therapist in me struggled with that. So we started having aftercare counseling and saying to families, you can come back for up to 3 months after you graduate. You can always call us forever, but for 3 months after you graduate, you can come back. Individual, family, group therapy, whatever you need to help you ease through that transition home. Because here's what happens when you go home and everything changes is your behavior does what? Lovely, lovely, lovely honeymoon. And we don't want the family to be by themselves when they hit that first big roadblock. Because how they work through that first roadblock is going to determine how they succeed. So we start saying, family therapy. Come on, come back. Get individual therapy for your kid. Get family therapy.
Do your families live pretty close?
Some do and some don't. So we take kids from anywhere, but what we tell families is about a 6-hour radius. Because we're not going to replace the parents, because we're going to expect you to be on campus every month. Further than 6 hours, families usually aren't successful. Because if your child gets sick, we're calling you, you need to come. If something happens, we're going to the hospital with your kid, you need to come. And if you're more than 6 hours away, that's just really hard to do. And like this month, it's Easter, and we have parent workshop. So this weekend, everybody has to come to campus, pick up their children for Easter. Next weekend, everybody has to come to campus, come to the parent workshop. But we've had families apply from as far away as California, because they're looking specifically for something that involves the whole family, and they don't want to have someone else become the parent and say, look, we could fly out every month. So we have not gotten all the way through, because usually there's some behavioral stuff that's going on when you're looking at Oklahoma from California that may be beyond what we can do. But so we say about 6 hours, but we do have a number of local families. But families weren't coming to the aftercare counseling. Only about 1 in 10 families took advantage of the aftercare counseling. And since we started Intentional Hope, 100% come at least once for aftercare, just to touch base. And we tell them, until you be getting a new therapist, but while you're in that gap, by all means, come back, call us, let us help you as you walk through this. So, yeah, but they can be anywhere. What we find is that if they're closer than 30 minutes, usually the kids are inclined to run away to home when things get bad. But if they're, and we're far enough out in the country, 20 minutes just gets you into the outside edge of town. So, but we will take families from anywhere if they can commit to being with us the way they need to be with us. But most of our families are within about 3.5 hours.
We probably need to go through the 9 steps real quick.
Oh, are we about to run out of time?
No. But we'd probably need to get there. What do you think? So, well, no, the first 3 steps are yours. Basically, we divide the steps into three categories. And again, you'll get this paper if you gave me your email. I'll send it to you as soon as I get back home here. And the first 3 steps basically are laying the foundation. And some of this models or mirrors the kids going up to. But basically, it's laying the foundation. Kind of maybe explain those first 3 steps there.
So the first step is safety. And it is the least invasive step in terms of what it's going to require of you. It's a very short assessment of who is your family and what needs do they have. And so we go through, do you have medical doctors? Do you have mental health help? Do you have any legal charges? Because it's really bad to find out when a family hasn't called for 3 weeks that the reason they haven't called is because mom's in jail. We want to know ahead of time if that's about to happen. So who are you? What are your needs? So we can do some case management with the family about what is it that you need? But it's not terribly invasive to say, like, do you have enough money from month to month? No, we really struggle. Okay, we need to know that. Thanks. But the other part of safety is you create safety. You assess safety in your own life. Are you safe? Are you in a situation that's not safe? You need to do something about that because you're not going to be able to do much while you're living in survival mode. And how do you create safety for your child, especially with your child being out of the home? And so that's the part where we say part of this first step is you make your phone calls, you show up for your visits, you come to your family counseling, you create consistency and make sure your kid knows that you're going to be there. The second step is about respect. Who has ever heard a parent say, the problem is my child does not respect me? Do we have any kids that the families don't say that? Right? So the second step is, what is respect? Define respect for you, for your family. What does it look like? What does it sound like? What do you see when people are being respectful? That's really fun. That's probably my favorite thing to do with families, because they haven't ever really a lot of times thought about that. Some families have, and they give you these beautiful things that almost look like treatment plans. And you know. Either mom is a therapist or mom has been through therapy a lot. But what does it look like? A lot of the families have never defined it. They know they're not getting it, but they don't know what exactly it is that they're looking for. So we have them define it. And then it usually, either with me or in family therapy, it fits to sit down with the child and go over that. Here's what we're looking for when we say respect. And that usually is done within the first month that they're with us. Meanwhile, the child's in our program, and our first three steps for the kids are respect for yourself, respect for your environment, respect for other people. So guess what word everyone's hearing lots of? And then step three, we say, who are you as a family and what are your rules? And this is where we sit down and say, here's the difference between a rule and an expectation, and let's make rules right now. And we'll work on the expectations, but let's talk about rules. No more than five, and sometimes people look at me and like I'm crazy, and they apply equally to everyone, and rules are absolutely non-negotiable. We do not negotiate about rules. 100% of the time, we follow the rules. So, for example, our basic five are respect yourself, respect your peers, respect the environment, respect the adults, and listen to the people that are in authority over you. Those five rules apply to me just as much as they apply to the kids. Right? And 100% of the time, it's not okay to violate those things. Now, we have other rules. Bedtime is at 8 o'clock. Sometimes we're going to violate that. Right? Sometimes we're going to go do something special and stay up past bedtime. That's not a rule, then. That's an expectation. I expect you to do your chores every week. But let's be really honest. If we just found out that you had a death in your family, the most pressing thing on the agenda tonight is not you getting the dishes scrubbed. It may be sitting with me and having a conversation about how you're doing. So expectations are flexible. Expectations change. Expectations may be different for different people in your family, but rules are solid, and you can count on them. So we go through that with the families and help them set up rules and write them down, and if they want us to, we'll laminate them so they can hang them in the home. And so usually by the time the child goes home for the first time, we've talked about what respect is supposed to look like, and we've got family rules hanging in the home. Sometimes that's new, sometimes that's not, but it's usually pretty useful. And then we get into the next three steps. So for our kids, steps 4, 5, and 6 are your individual work, where we might work on anger management, or we might work on you learning how to have appropriate relationships with people, or you taking ownership for your own success in your life. And the parent stuff is very similar. So step 4 is your parenting skills. That's coming to the parent workshops, talking about the parent workshops, learning the new skills.
We actually require 12 hours a year of our parents to come to campus for workshops. 24 hours. And we do Parenting with Love and Logic. I've done that for years, even in marriage counseling. But we do 12 hours or two sets of 6 hours on the Parenting with Love and Logic skills. It's fantastic. We teach that to our our residential life specialists. There's another curriculum called 9 Essential Skills for Every Classroom Teacher. It's basically the same stuff, but it's just packaged for teachers. And I teach that to our school. So everyone on campus has been trained in love and logic, and it's just a lot of fun, because, you know, when a kid comes and complains about something, our first reaction is, oh, that's so sad.
And where it gets fun, and this happened to me last week, so I teach a Wednesday night class, and if one of our kids is kind of struggling, they get to come help me teach my Wednesday night class instead of going to the teen class. And so we have one of our girls who's just struggling, and we have this little wild boy who jumped up on top of the table, and she looked at him and goes, oh, that's so sad. We're going to have to do something about that, which is a love and logic thing to say. It was hilarious, it was appropriate, and like, you know. So, my thing I say is, well, that's a choice. Yeah. And one of the girls said to another girl, you better watch out. When Miss Jennifer says that, it means something's about to happen. You're probably not going to like it. You might want to make a different choice.
That's the cool thing about love and logic, is we do a lot of offering to help the child out. Oh, don't worry, I'll take care of it. But they know that something bad's coming. If I take care of...
Something useful is coming. Useful.
Something usefully bad is coming. So anyway, on this step four, we have the 24 hours of workshops that they have to come to, 12-hour parenting with love and logic, 6 hours on trauma, and 6 hours on forgiveness and reconciliation, because that's a big, big deal with us. Step five is focusing on the positive, and we do a lot of helping kids out. Another thing about love and logic is what they teach is always lift your kids up, because that's what we're trying to do in parenting. And one of the things that they propose is that when your kids are doing chores, every once in a while go up and say, would you like some help? Now, we're not going to do the chore for them. In fact, we're going to do less work than they do on that chore, but we need to be there to help them out, to lift them up, to build them up. And we also are going to have the parents list positive things about everyone in their family. So if there are 6 children in the family plus the 2 adults, they have 8 lists to list out. And then go through that and cull that. And as soon as everyone's done with their list, as a family, they sit down and share with each other. So it's just a really good positive attitude there. See, we're rebuilding the family from the ground up. And then focusing on you or telling your story is step number 6. And one of the things that we do in this particular step is we have them come up with a color-coded timeline of their life with the child. And I remember doing this in a doctoral seminar. It was actually a retreat setting up in the beautiful state of Washington up there. And they required us that we took sticky notes. And the yellow ones, we put all the good stuff that's ever happened to us. And on the red notes, all the bad stuff that ever happened. And then we just started putting it on a timeline. And you could see that my groupings of reds were about the same place. And, whenever something special or different was happening in my life, that's where those reds tags kind of grouped there. And so it's just kind of an eye-opening experience to kind of let the family see, you know, our life has kind of been like this. And this is what happened. This is what we did. It wasn't good. But then we did this and that was good. And so it's just a really good teaching opportunity, a therapy opportunity for the family. So that's step number 6.
So the last 3 steps for our kids are where they start doing family work. And so they'll have goals like before every pass, you sit down and you make goals about what you want to accomplish on this pass. And then when you come back, you sit down and assess how you're doing. And teenagers love to do this. No, they don't. They hate it. But it's really useful because they start having goals for their family interactions. And that just shifts how you are with your family. And so they will have goals about that. They will have goals about problem solving. They will have goals about having conversations with their family members. So while they're doing that, our parents start with servanthood. And they plan a service project together. And they begin to do service projects together. So they're focused on someone else and doing good things for someone else.
The Bible teaches, by the way, because I'm a preacher too, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, I don't know, somewhere in Peter 2:13, you are to be submissive in every situation or every relationship that you find yourself in. Christianity is a lifestyle of being a servant. That's what Jesus did for us. That's what God did for us. And that's actually healthy. I mean, it's actually medically healthy when you serve. I always teach in my medical, or not my medical, my marriage workshops, a thing called the Mother Teresa effect. Has anyone ever heard of the Mother Teresa effect? Okay, well, you'd have because I've been talking to you a lot. Back in the 1980s, what happened in our country, there was this virus that invaded our country. It was HIV, AIDS virus, and it destroyed people's immune systems so where they couldn't fight off what I would consider normal diseases, like pneumonia. In fact, most AIDS patients will die of some strain of pneumonia. Okay, so in the 1980s, the medical science had 2 jobs. Number 1, get rid of HIV, and they've not been able to do that. But number 2, in the meantime, what can we do to boost people's immune systems? And so it was a Harvard medical researcher that took his medical students one day and had them sit down and watch a video clip of Mother Teresa doing her acts of kindness or acts of service in Calcutta, India, to people who could never repay her in a million years. And he tested their saliva before the video and after the video and found out that just by watching acts of service being done, they were medically healthier. Their immune systems were strengthened. And then they sent him out to do acts of service. And so that particular experiment has been repeated by every school of psychology and every school of medicine in our nation. And so being a servant, well, it's biblical, but it's also the healthiest lifestyle. And if we can get parents to serve again like they used to with kids, I mean, kids are born, we are totally their servant. And we like it until they're about 2 years old, and then we just don't like them anymore. Kind of like in marriage. Marriage, you know, the first couple of years are fine, but then you're thinking, well, anyway, that's a whole nother subject. So being a servant is what we want to do.
And here's the reality. Being a servant works whether you're a Christian or not. It's good for you to focus on other people and other things. And so, you know, some of our families, okay, fine, we're going to do a service project. And so, but some families really get into it and end up finding something that they connect to, and that becomes a new foundation for them. So it's wonderful that way. Step 8, family connection and problem solving. This is where you learn how to have a family meeting, and we sit down and say, okay, how do we talk about problems in a way that's constructive and feels good and doesn't devolve into a screaming match? How do we know when to say, you know, we're going to table this till later? And we're very structured about that. And then step 9 is your family story. So the family takes the adult story that they made in step 6, where they've said, this is who I am. Somewhere along the line, the child has done their story. And they actually sit down together and make a family story and say, this is who we are, this is where we've been, this is where we're going, and here's our plan for the future. And so, which is a lovely, that one usually ends up happening inside of family therapy because it just fits so well as a therapeutic intervention. And it is their graduation moment when they have done that.
And it's really a beautiful thing to watch families reconcile. And again, we keep in touch with them afterwards, and hopefully they'll come back and get some more help. But it's just, it's really a great model. We've had several that have gone through it. We don't have many hard statistics to give you at this time, but in 3 years, when you come to Claremore for this workshop or this conference, we'll have some stats for you on how well it works. But we're excited.
It does. But what we know is that it doesn't work all the time, right? Like, we're not here today to tell you that we have a model that will create beautiful reconciliation for every family that you've ever encountered. Because that's just not the reality. So what do you guys think of as barriers for family reconciliation? Do you have barriers?
Mm-hmm. Family interaction, mostly.
Yeah.
Just trying to get families involved.
Mm-hmm. They're done and they're not going to connect.
Mm-hmm. When she moved in, they brought everything that she owns. Mm-hmm. And I was just in shock.
With no intention of her coming back.
Mm-hmm. This is my whole
life. Yeah.
And we're still struggling with them even coming to what we call staffless support.
Yeah. One of the things that we do is that we actually... in our interviews, that's one of the things that we establish. Is there a family to go back to, and is this family ready, willing to have this child come back? And if they don't, there is a big chance that we're not even going to accept the child.
But there are two types of reconciliation. So there's physical reconciliation, where you're going to live in my house and we're going to behave like a traditional family again. And sometimes that's not a good goal. So our goal for those families, because sometimes that's true, right? If you have harmed your little sibling and created damage for them, it may not be good for anyone for you to go back and live in that house. If you have physically assaulted your parents to where they've had to go to the hospital, it may not be good for you to go back to that house. It may not be safe for any of you. But there is emotional reconciliation. So can we say, even if we can't live back in a home together, can we build a relationship to where we can stay connected? Because guess what? By the time they come to us, they're not going to be kids for that much longer. You know, 5-6 years, maybe. But adulthood is coming. And it matters more for your adult life that you have a base to go to. Someone to spend the holidays with, someone you can call. So even if we're not going to try to rebuild living back in your home, can we build enough relationship where you can still be a support for your child, you can still be connected, they could spend holidays with you, and they could call you when they have problems. Because some families that living back home may not work can still work to that. And some families aren't willing to do any kind of reconciliation, and there's not a lot you can do about that. And that just is a flat barrier. But I try to talk to those families about, like, so what, how much reconciliation can you give? Is there, like, what can you do for this child because you did make a commitment, either by birth or adoption?
What other barriers have you guys run into, or are possible barriers that you might think of for family reconciliation?
This is probably part of the second one, but we're running into a few barriers with, I guess it could be considered either blended families or split families.
Mm-hmm.
Where we have one parent that has custody and has placed the child there for help, but there's another parent or someone outside of that that's who the child is drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the issue. And then obviously a blended family, you know, there are steps and halves and everything else that aren't going to be part of the solution, but they're a big part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
We would try to get both of those into family counseling, and we've done that before. It's not always a great thing, but that would be the ideal. Just say, you guys have this child together, or this father and stepmother and the natural mother or the birth mother. We try to get them all together. Now, if that, a lot of times that's not possible, but we work as best we can with them. But that is definitely a barrier. If there's two families fighting over the same kid here.
Yep. Our best place we have the best luck is when you get about a year in and they're starting to see the child change, and sometimes you can get some openness about, like, you're seeing that things get better. Here's an idea. You don't have to do it, but it's just an idea. If maybe this other parent would consider coming in just for one family therapy session and just maybe one time and see, not to replace what you're doing, in addition, but let's try that. And sometimes we can get them in that way and start building some connection and cohesion. And sometimes, some families, it's just not going to happen.
And that's where we are with a few of ours is, you know, when the child goes back,
mm-hmm.
the family situation is not going to have changed that much.
Mm-hmm.
We will at least give the child the tools and the support and the understanding that there is a better way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So.
And that's what we can do 100% of the time, is give the child that structure and that network and that vision of what maybe something different looks like for themselves.
We have had a situation where a child is placed with us, and the mother and dad, yes, we'll do everything, and in the meantime, their marriage falls apart, and they go their separate ways. Well, that's that presents a problem with reconciliation. And also helping the child now that he's here and the family split up, what do we do now? So there's lots of individual things like that happen a lot to many of our families in different ways. So we've been around for 72 years. We got lots of stories.
But yeah, it's a challenge, right? Our kids live in chaos. If we get really honest about the root of why they come to any of us, is that there's some degree of unaddressed chaos. And sometimes they bring that chaos to us. Sometimes. 100% of the time, they bring that chaos to us.
What are the barriers do you see, possible barriers for family reconciliation in your lives?
What is one thing you guys have done that's worked for family reconciliation? Have you done, or do you do?
Send them back. Have you guys done much with reconciliation?
I mean, for us, we haven't. I mean, you know, we work with state-placed children,
yeah.
So it's kind of out of our hands.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
But I think with the two families first, they're going to be really asking us to do a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really thankful for this information. Jim Robin calling you, I know.
Absolutely call me. Absolutely call me.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of that, you know, is controlled, you know, mm-hmm. by,
that's
you
true.
Know, judges and courts and, you know, caseworkers.
Mm-hmm. And getting their buy-in is hard. Mm-hmm. I have long believed and shared this opinion with our friends at RDHS, that we would be a perfect placement for especially older kids going into an adoption with people they don't know. That rather than dunk them into a family that they don't know and letting it dissolve and then having them come to us after the adoption is final, it would be cool to do some front-end work and let them get to know each other and develop a relationship that way. It has never happened. Because here's what happens with at least RDHS is they go, oh, cool, we've located a family. Done. Thank you, we're pulling them today. And then sometimes the family comes back 6 months later and says, hey, about that thing that we were going to do.
And what we're saying too, there was a huge push, you know, for permanency and adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these younger kids, they're, you know, like things, not really doing matching, not really doing a lot of this, you know, preemptive work, you know, just, you know, hopefully to be successful. And we're seeing these kids cycle back in, you know, when they hit out in less than 15, 16, because they're traumatized, the parents weren't, you know, ready or educated on what to do for them.
And the parents know that. I can't tell you how many parents have sat in my office and cried and said, we didn't know, we weren't prepared, no one warned us. And it's like, you can't do anything about that now.
Yeah.
But let me start warning you about how this is going to go, because these are brave parents. They love their kids, but they're in over their head.
Right.
And families first is not going to change that. But it is, it's going to push us for family reconciliation, and we're going to have to figure out the best way to work around that.
Sounds to me like successful reconciliation, a lot of it depends on support after they go back home, because it seems like with rehab, if you liken it to rehab, they go into rehab, but when they leave there, they go back to their normal life and they fall back into the same problems. And I would think that families would be the same way. If they don't have that outside support where, like you said, they can call you, then they're going to fall back into the same old patterns.
Right. So we try to prep ahead of time. Here's what's going to happen. You're going to go home, and it is going to be great, and it's all going to be wonderful for a while, maybe a few days or a few weeks, might even be a few months, but you're going to have a day. It's going to be a bad day. And on that day, something's going to happen. It's going to be really bad. You and your parents are going to get in a fight, and one or both of you is going to say, I wish I was back at Hope Harbor. This tends to really distress the kids, especially when they're the ones saying, I wish I was back at Hope Harbor, because, you know, they're teenagers. Fun as we are, they don't necessarily always love us while they're there, and their goal is to go home and be not with us. Strangest thing. And then they go home, and then they're like, oh, I want to be back there. Like, be ready. On that day, call us, because that day is going to determine what happens next and whether you are able to sit down and work together to get through it, or whether you throw your hands up, say, well, things are now because we've had this bad day as they always were, and we all go back to all the things we did before we invested however many years of our life in this process. So we try to predict for them to try to help mitigate that. And a lot of the kids will call and say, it happened. And sometimes that helps. So if you know the bad thing is coming, you're better prepared to deal with it.
I'm sorry. We need to stop. Because we're supposed to scram out of our hotel rooms here and get to a luncheon in about half an hour. We thank you very much for being here. And call us anytime, and I will send you these things. You can call us, email us. And if you have a question or you want some explanation, clarification, we'd be more than willing to do that for you. I gave the brochures out already. Thank you very much. All right.